knights and fair maidens, adventure and romance, triumph and tragedy, chivalry and villainy. These are the Middle Ages, and this is your gateway to the medieval world. I invite you to step back in time and experience All Things Medieval, the podcast dedicated to bringing you knowledge, tales, and insights into the Middle Ages of the past, the present, and of the future. Welcome, most noble lords and ladies, to this, the May 2008 episode of the All Things Medieval podcast. I'm Sir Justin, as regular listeners may already discern, and I'd like to say welcome to new listeners and also welcome to listeners of old, and thanks for tuning in. I always kick off the show a little bit. I talk a little bit about my medieval life since the last show, so I guess we'll get into that. It's really been, I guess you would say, same old, I suppose. I've been doing a lot of shows with the museum and doing various private appearances and things such as that. Something that I have been doing a lot of these last few weeks since we last conversed is I've been doing a lot of research. I've been going through some old books which I've had, which I haven't opened up and had a look at for some time. You know what I find is really interesting? I'm the sort of person when I get a book, I must admit the first thing I look at is pictures. So if there's some really cool pictures in there, it will. I'm generally sold on a book. Second most important, of course, is content and its relevance to the interests that I have in the Middle Ages, which, as regular listeners will already know, is mostly 14th century English, or I guess you could even say the Hundred Years' War or the first half of it. So that's generally what I have a look at. Now, as a result, I'll pick up a book which I find of interest and I'll have a flick through it and I'll think, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And then I'll look at the parts that I want to look at and then I'll shelf it and won't bother looking at it. And then some time later, whether it's completely by accident or whether on a forum or mailing list or somewhere else or someone else's suggestion or a book review, I'll read something about the book or discover something about the book which, because I hadn't read it front to cover, is totally new to me. So I find it fascinating going through my bookshelf and looking at books which I've had some of them for several years now, and I'll go through and I'll learn something new and exciting, and I'll think, wow, why didn't I just read this book from cover to cover, and I would have known this many years ago. And I guess that's part of the excitement of researching the Middle Ages and history in general, I suppose. I have to admit, there's probably only a few books that I have actually read from cover to cover, because I do a lot of writing and a lot of, I guess you would say, research which has practical applications. I tend to find something which I'm missing currently in my repertoire or knowledge bank, and I'll look at something specifically. It could be something, it could range from a swordsmanship technique or style, from perhaps the Lichtenauer books or something along those lines, published by Chivalry Bookshelf, the ones done by Christian Tobler or Tolber. I'd have to get up and have a look at the book, and I'm not going to do that. That sounds like a lot of effort. That's what I have servants for. So generally, or it could even be calligraphy. I might decide that I really need to learn how to do some writing, some very basic level writing for my medieval performances, and so I'll purchase a book on calligraphy and I'll just look at the practical bits that I really need to get me out of trouble. But for example, just the other week I was looking through the calligraphy book and found some really fascinating information on literature in the Middle Ages. So hopefully I'll share a little bit about that with you in future episodes, or possibly even in this episode, because as yet I haven't decided what our main feature is going to be. I've got a few ideas kicking around in my head. I know that I've said that I'd get Cliff Turpin on the show, and also Matthew Hoffman from the Marksbruder, who teaches German swordsmanship. I've said that they're going to be on the show, but as of yet, it's been really hard to nail down a time where I can meet with these individuals and talk with them about things. So what I've decided I'm going to do is no longer promise what's coming up on an upcoming episode, other than to say that certain things are in the works. Certain pieces about courtly love and German swordsmanship as well. So, and I have every intention to still do these interviews with these interesting and knowledgeable individuals. But rather than tell you guys when it's going to happen, I'll probably just, or rather than tell you in advance when it's going to happen, I'll probably just say sometime in the future this is going to happen, and then it, lo and behold, it will turn up on a podcast, hopefully. So that's pretty much, I guess, my medieval life in a nutshell since the last time we met. And that's pretty much a little bit about the future for the episode, or intentions that I have for the podcast. So if you do have any suggestions, I like to get the contact information out at the front and at the end of the show so it doesn't bog it down during the middle. But if you do have any suggestions or feedback or input, anything else like that, do get in touch with me here at the podcast. You can get in touch with me at the in the forums as well. So where you can find all this wonderful stuff is pretty much the central hub of it is my own personal website, www.sirjustin.com, and that is Justin with a Y, so that's T-Y-N rather than T-I-N, a medieval variant of the spelling which seemed to be more commonplace in 14th century England than the I-N variation. Or you can contact me at podcast@sirjustin.com and tell me what's been happening in your medieval world as well, if you've got the time. Tell me you like the podcast, tell me you hate the podcast, tell me how I can fix it, tell me it doesn't need fixing, tell me whatever you like, okay? Tell me what you need to tell me. So, with that out of the way, I guess we'll move on to the Herald's Call news thingy. Majigami, what's it?
Bringing you the latest happenings from across the kingdom, here comes the All Things Medieval Herald in the Herald's Call.
Thank you, Herald. Go and get yourself an ale and something to eat. Oh, and by the way, when you park your horse in the stall, please don't take the priest's spot. Every time you do, he complains so much about it that I get a headache, so let him have his space. Thank you very much. So, Herald's Call news for May 2008. We'll start right off with this little gem, Domino's Goes Medieval. Check out YouTube and search Medieval Domino's or Epic Feast and have yourself a chuckle. I still do every time I watch it, and I've been watching it, well, maybe once or twice each day, and I have a good old laugh about it. It's a great little video. It's got a... I imagine a lot of our listeners from the United States of America are probably familiar with it because it is an ad from over that way. But hey, we're a little bit behind in the times over here in Australia, at least with that sort of thing where that's concerned. But check it out, it's a great little clip. On to more, I guess, meaty news. 13th century English coin hoard found in Sweden near Lund, or it could be pronounced Lund if it's from Sweden. A 9-year-old lad and his grandfather went searching for cannonballs and shrapnel on an old battlefield and found themselves with over 4,500 silver coins from the 13th century. Archaeologists found more, increasing the count to over 7,000, and claim there could be even more to be found. The silver's been estimated to be worth 1.5 million kroner, or $250,000. During the 13th century, when the coins were estimated to be hidden, the sum could have fetched some 15 serfs, museum head Per Karsten said. The coins have been placed in two urns that were wrapped in cloth, and the treasure was likely buried during troubled times. One theory was that the coins were church taxes collected from nearby farms. The find included thousands of English coins with a high silver content and some other markers that were likely used locally. This next news story I've titled Feeling a Wee Bit Ill. Scientists have claimed that the medieval practice of studying urine samples may have had merit. So they used to study the colour, smell and even the taste of urine. And it was once the primary means of diagnosis for physicians during the Middle Ages. Anatomy studies were rare and very few post-mortem examinations were done, so urine was one of the few diagnostic tools available. One textbook listed 20 possible colours of urine, and belief in urine analysis began in the late classical era, around about the 6th century, and lasted unchallenged into the Renaissance, when doctors were at last permitted to dissect bodies. And it's now being touted by a research team at Imperial College London that it can reveal much about an individual's current state of health. The team has completed the first worldwide study of the metabolites or breakdown products that are found in urine, reflecting the diet, inheritance and lifestyle of the people from whom it came. They say that urine differs in subtle ways that could provide a powerful new way of linking diet and health. They are calling it metabolic profiling, and they say it can tell us how specific aspects of a person's diet and how much they drink are contributing to their risks for certain diseases, and these are things which we can't investigate by looking at a person's DNA. I don't mean to laugh. I'm not discrediting their research or anything. I just kind of find it, it is a little bit humorous, you must admit. So onto something else a little bit humorous. Kids these days. We all see and hear the reports of the dreaded hoodie-wearing criminals that terrorize society, whether alone, in pairs, or in groups or gangs, and the hooded sweatshirt has somewhat become iconic in regard to these foul churls. Well, according to historian Professor Robert Bartlett, youth gangs are nothing new. They existed in 12th century London and wore hooded garments which hid their identities during rampages. The worst offenders were the teenage apprentice boys of London, lawless, violent, and the scourge of the capital. They were away from home for 7 years with no parental control, and they would riot regularly for political and religious reasons, said Bartlett. Well, I suppose at least back then they were rioting and carrying on like duffers for a reason, unlike today. Well, possibly they have a reason, and this reason could be because, damn it, they didn't have enough toys when they were young. So, this segues nicely into the next news story, which is Build Your Own Castle. Lego is releasing an exclusive collector's Lego chess set based on their mythic medieval castle world. It's to be released in July. Sells at $300 Australian, and the board is 43 centimetres square with a cool collection of figures and the like. It looks awesome. Check it out at lego.com. Takes me back to my childhood. So maybe if those hoodies had their own Lego, castle Lego, when they were younger, possibly they would have grown up differently. Poor little buggers. But anyway, that's about it for the news this month. Fairly light on, but I found it a little bit hard to find some news stories this month. So if you have something of interest, and it can range from movie rumours or even computer game rumours to Lego and urine, whatever you like. If you think it's interesting or quaint or humorous, send me an email and we'll get it onto the show. So that's about it for the news for this month, and we'll move into the next segment. Come one, come all, lords and ladies, fellow countrymen and women, gather round and hear all about exciting events, fairs and tournaments coming soon to our fair lands. I have a couple of events which, although they're a little bit too late to report upon for anyone to attend them, I just thought I'd mention them for the sake of, at least you'll be aware of them, and hopefully it will serve as a reminder to myself as well. I do apologise. The first one I actually didn't find out about until just before I started recording this program. So it unfortunately, well, I'll talk about it now. It was the Congress on Medieval Studies, and it was held May 8th to the 11th, 2008, at Western Michigan University, Kalamazoo, Michigan. Now, as I said, I only just discovered it today, so by the time this goes to air, so to speak, it will probably have already been and probably mostly gone. But at least now you'll know for the next time, right? And I'll keep an eye out for it as well, and hopefully we'll catch on to it before it happens next time with plenty of advance warning, and we can advertise it here on All Things Medieval. Another event that has been and gone, but was mentioned, albeit in brief detail, in the last podcast, was the Hackerland Tournament of Chivalry in Belgium. I'll put the website in the notes, so next time the event is on, you'll have more notice and be able to check it out. From what I understand, it's a very good event. It's run by a gentleman, or I believe it's run by a gentleman called Fred Perot, and he's quite an accomplished jouster and quite the gentleman as well. So I'm sure it would be a worthwhile event to head along and check out if you're in that area. The next event I have is the Lee Yorkey Woodson Art Museum in Wisconsin, USA. currently have an exhibition of arms and armour on display from the Higgins Armoury Museum, and a photographic display called Suburban Warriors, which contains a collection of artistic prints. That's prints as in photo prints, not prints as in, you know, the royal kind, depicting members of the SCA. Check it out if you're in the area. It's on display throughout the summer season of the Northern Hemisphere, and while you're there, check out the Oakshott Institute Master Armourer's Residency, running from Tuesday, May 13th to Sunday, May 18th, 2008. And you get a front row seat to watch as Master Armourers from the Oakshott Institute, Minneapolis, forge steel into armour and demonstrate the do's and the don'ts of wearing armour on the battlefield and in polite society. All demonstrations are held in a tent on the museum's ground, and for more information about any of those exhibits or displays, go to their website, www.lywam.org, and I'll put that in the schnotes as well, and go and check it out. It looks interesting. The next event is History Alive at Fort Lytton, Brisbane, Australia, and it's on June 7th and 8th with living history displays covering 2,000 years of history. Their website is www.historyalive.org.au, and we've gone through this, I think, pretty much every episode. It's a fort from the 1880s, so on and so forth, and it's now a venue for the Living History Federation, or Queensland Living History Federation's yearly event called History Alive. It has everything going from ancients right up to Vietnam, and they have a good whack of medieval displays and living history groups. So check it out if you're in the area and get the chance to. It's well worth going to have a look at. We have a new event, Gen Con Oz. Although not a medieval event per se, the Gen Con events have an interest to medieval and fantasy enthusiasts worldwide, and this year one is finally coming to Australia. Gen Con Oz is dedicated to the best 4 days in gaming and covers role-playing games, trading card games, board games, miniature war games, and here in Australia it will also represent video games. Everything associated with gaming culture is represented, as well as including art, music, merchandise, movies, and the list goes on and on. It's on the weekend before the Abbey tournament, running from the 3rd to the 6th of July at the Brisbane Convention Centre. Check out Gen Con Oz, and if you're in Australia for Gen Con, then remember you can always stay a bit longer for the greatest medieval event in the Southern Hemisphere, the Abbey Medieval Festival. It's a week-long event culminating in a 2-day fair and tournament. It's held in Caboolture, 30 minutes from the central business district of Brisbane, which that's pretty much where Gen Con Oz is being held. And for more details, including details of their banquet, go to www.abbeytournament.com. The festival week includes a plethora of events such as the tournament, banquet, mask balls, night school for kids, children's day, workshops, art exhibits, competitions, jester school, cooking class, trivia team competitions, and a knighting ceremony. It's the biggest and best event in the Southern Hemisphere, and if you're in Brisbane when it's on, I can't urge you enough to check it out. That probably sounds identical to last month's plug, because I've pretty much just cut and pasted into the show notes. What I will try and do is I'll try and add a little bit more to it. How about I have a go at it right now? I'll tell you a little bit about the knighting ceremony. The knighting ceremony is done in a 14th century style, and it's done in the Abbey Church, St. Michael's Abbey Church, and there's stained glass windows in that church which have been brought over to Australia and put into the church. And the earliest one, I believe, is an 11th century piece, and they're actually, it's all medieval stained glass, though there is some 18th century windows, I believe. Not too sure, I'd have to look into that a little bit more. It's really a fantastic experience, the knighting ceremony. I was actually knighted in the church by the same order, which is the Knights Order of Lion Rampant. It's where I earned my spurs, so to speak, was in that reenactment group. And it's really a surreal experience. You have a church full of reenactors dressed in their best court gear and such, and you see people being knighted. This year, one of my One of my friends has actually been knighted, Master Brian Kettley. So congratulations, Brian, if you're listening to this. I hope I can let the cat out of the bag. If not, don't worry too much. It's just between us and maybe 200 of our closest friends. Okay, so congratulations, Brian. And if anyone is in the area and wants to see a recreation of a knighting ceremony, the public are welcome to come along and take photos and such and things like that. It really is worthwhile checking out if you're in the area. And that's a free event as well. So you just turn up at the church on the Friday evening and you have a look-see. There's a bit of a Latin mass and a few other, medieval-ish things which happen during the knighting ceremony, and a nice big display as well of tournament shields and things like that. So head along and check that out. Now we're going to move on to our next segment, which is the mystery feature. And now it's time for the All Things Medieval Podcast main feature. Listen to discourse and interviews where we talk about a featured topic or chat with a special guest. And so our mystery feature this month, the reason I call it a mystery feature and I touched on it a little bit earlier on in the podcast, is because I didn't really have a bloody clue what I was going to talk about. I've got a lot of ideas of different things kicking around, but to be honest, I actually haven't taken time from my busy schedule to actually get anything down. So this month I'm going to wing it a little bit. I find it's really odd, you know. I think I'm finally starting to settle into the whole podcasting thing and seemingly talking to myself about medieval things. But one of the things that I do with my performances is I'm actually speaking in public quite often, and it's something which is really easy to do. I find I can talk for hours and hours about medieval things without. Quite often I'm running overtime in my shows and things like that because, well, it's just hard to shut me up once I get started. And I can tend to ramble on and digress, which I'm sure you've probably noticed, even if this is just your first episode. But, see, now I've lost my place. But basically what I was saying is I can speak to the public really easily, but when I come in here to speak, I generally have to read from a script. And I think that's really odd that I need to do that. I must admit the scripts are getting less and less detailed with each passing episode, and I think that's got a lot to do with my comfort levels while I'm doing the show. So this will be interesting. I may be prone to rambling a little bit, so a bit of a disclaimer. We're going to talk this month about ladies in the Middle Ages, courtly love, and about ladies in reenactment in general in today's day and age. Now, because I don't have a lot of notes, I will be sort of winging it a fair bit, so there's another disclaimer there, so please be aware of that. Also, I'm not terribly familiar on the subject. Sadly, most medieval reenactment here in Australia, at least, I'm sure it's probably different elsewhere, it tends to focus mostly on the blokey stuff. So we're talking about, and when I say blokey stuff, I mean combat. It seems to be the primary focus of most reenactment groups and medieval performers here in Australia, which I think is sad because there's a whole lot more to the Middle Ages than just fighting. Fighting, really, when you look at it on a grand scale, and I believe Geoffrey Hedgecock mentioned this in last month's episode, that the wars and the combats and the battles were really, in comparison to their daily lives, were just a small portion of their lives. And even the great battles were just generally one-day events, which, although they may have had further-reaching consequences, generally just came and went fairly swiftly. So it's odd that we focus so much time and dedication to perfecting these arts. Obviously, they were an important art, and it was required, especially if you were a gentleman. And sadly, the ladies seem to get neglected. And so that is, if I can, in a long-winded way, explain my situation about the knowledge I have on ladies, that's why I don't have a lot of knowledge on it. I am trying to rectify that. I've been studying the role of ladies and trying to understand them a little bit more. But generally, because of my experience with reenactment, I'm sadly lacking in the subject. So Most of what you're going to hear is mostly from opinion. I'll be reading some passages from certain books, which I find interesting. But as I say, most of it will be personal opinion. So if anyone is knowledgeable on this whatsoever, do get in touch with me. I do have in mind a couple of ladies that I'd like to speak to who are much more learned on the subject than I, but at least this may be a good start, and hopefully it will instigate a bit of discussion on the forums and possibly some feedback, and then hopefully we can get someone else on the show who knows a lot more than I do and can educate us all on the role of medieval ladies. We may as well start. The common misconception that I believe we have about the Middle Ages and ladies in the Middle Ages today is that they were powerless, that they had very little say in things that were happening in their day-to-day life. They had to be obedient to men, unquestionably so. And to an extent, I believe that was right. We may as well not beat about the bush, and we can say that medieval society, from how we seem to view it in this day and age, certainly was a chauvinistic society. That meant that the men were in charge, and the ladies did have to play a submissive role. Now, it didn't mean that the ladies were powerless, far from it. And indeed, all throughout history, there's the old saying, behind every great man, there's a great woman who stands firmly beside him or behind him. In the Middle Ages, I don't think that was any different, really. We often think that that the ladies had very little to do except to sew and to participate in courtly arts and things like that. But especially speaking from a nobleman's point of view, the lady was very important to the household for a couple of reasons. She was important, first of all, because she would provide an heir. She would continue the family line, and it would pretty much move on through the generations. It was very important. And it sounds a little tasteless to say that, or to put that at the forefront, that the ladies, one of their primary tasks was to breed. But I guess if you're going to put it into that context, you could say that that was one of the man's most important tasks as well, is to breed and provide an heir, because you can't have an heir without a lady and a man. It just starts to get crazy and starts to look like the 21st century. Oops, but never mind. Just strike that from the record. I shouldn't get political about it. But anyway, so one of the other primary roles which a lady took on in the noble household, at least, was that of, I guess, a finance manager. She was in charge of the day-to-day running of the household, which we think of it today when we think of household, we think of it on a very small scale, but really it's not that much different. I mean, think about it for a moment, especially listeners who are in families. If I can talk to the gents just for a moment. Think about how your household would function if your lady, if your wife wasn't present. So especially if you've got kids, things like that, who pays the bills, who clothes the children, who feeds the children, who does all this sort of thing. And we live in a society which today it's a society of convenience. So everything's meant to be convenient. You can go out and buy clothes and put them on the kids. You buy the kids a new pair of shoes, off you go, that kind of thing. You pay the bills by telephone or by internet these days, so it's all fairly easy to take care of. Imagine if you didn't have these wonderful shops where you could just race out and do your grocery shopping or buy clothes and things like that, but someone still has to ensure that the food is coming in, that the food's on the table, that the children are clothed, that well, the adults, for that matter, are clothed as well, especially in Europe during winter time. I guess that would be kind of important. Not so much here in Australia, but I guess over there it would be. Imagine if you had to do all that stuff without the modern conveniences. It becomes quite a task. So think for a moment the sort of time that you might spend on these sort of tasks in today's day and age. Relate it back to then, when you didn't have phones, you didn't have convenience stores or clothing that you could just buy off the rack, so to speak, and shoes and different things like that. Someone's got to be in charge of running all of that kind of thing. Now, outside of a royal household, of course, there'd be servants that take care of all that. But in a fairly, I guess, a modest noble's house, or even in a commoner's house for that matter, it's the lady who needs to be in charge, or needs to have a finger on the pulse with all of these kind of duties and tasks. Now, today, because there's a lot of pressure on ladies to become professionals or to excel in their chosen profession and to go out and make something of themselves, and I'm not criticising ladies who do that. I think that's fantastic, but I do criticise society that put down ladies who are stay-at-home mums. I think that's a very important role. Back then it was considered, it was the lady's primary duty to make sure that all of these things were in good running order, because if they're not, then pretty much your whole world's going to fall down around you. I mean, if you can't manage your own household, your own family, how are you going to manage to serve someone greater? So it was a reflection on their role in society, or their position in society, I should say, and it was considered something very important. In fact, the lady who became a professional in the Middle Ages, she would be scrutinised fairly closely. They'd be wondering, you know, is she capable of performing these duties? Generally, she'd only become a professional if her husband died. So we're talking merchant class, middle class artisans and things like that. The lady would learn the husband's trade. And if he passed on, she could legally take over that trade, provided she could show that she was capable of doing it, as well as not neglecting her duties to her family. And to her, if she had a lady or lord whom she served. So it was a very important role, one which we sort of gloss over and one which we take for granted in this day and age. So they were the two primary sort of things that a lady was in charge of. So again, finances as well. A lady had to be in charge of finances. Generally, it's sort of a lot like... the relationship I have with my wife today. I make the money, I come home and give it to her before I go and spend it on silly things like tons of books and new swords and armor and different things like that. So, I mean, it's good to have a lady in control of those finances, and they pretty much would more or less... I shouldn't say dole out the money, but oversee what money was being spent. And quite often they were very powerful and very astute business women as well, and they could take care of those sort of things. One book which I think is a fantastic resource for ladies in the Middle Ages, and I must admit I haven't read it cover to cover. I've read portions of it, and I will get into reading it from cover to cover sometime soon, is Catherine de Pizan's The Treasure of the City of Ladies. Now, the book, it's available, it's a Penguin's classic, so if you go to penguinclassics.com and have a look for Christine de Pizan, you'll find it without any problem. She's had quite a few books. I find that this one is probably the most practical and the best book, and it describes a lady's role in the Middle Ages. It was written by... I'll just read off the blurb on the back of the book. It's written by Europe's first professional woman writer. The Treasure of the City of Ladies offers advice and guidance to women of all ages and from all levels of medieval society, from royal courtiers to prostitutes. It paints an intricate picture of daily life in the courts and streets of 15th century France and gives a fascinating glimpse into the practical considerations of running a household, maintaining a reputation, dressing appropriately, and behaving well in all circumstances. It really is, it's an awesome book. It has a lot of stuff in here which is really practical. It even says how a lady should address her superior when we're talking perhaps a maid addressing the lady of the house, if she feels that there is a problem with the man of the house, if the man's being unfaithful or something like that. It even gives instruction on how she should approach the lady and inform her or speak to her. Some of the chapters, they are really, really interesting, and it does give a good glimpse into how a lady in the Middle Ages ideally should have behaved. Now, before I get into too much trouble by saying that, I would just like to point out, if there's any ladies out there at the moment thinking, oh, you're a sexist pig, Sir Justin, how dare you, you know, talk about this book or, you know, suggesting how ladies should behave, do keep in mind that there were books as well for gentlemen. There were books for priests, there were books for men-at-arms, there was books for, not so much for the common levels of society, because, well, they weren't even meant to read, really. So before, like, I don't mean to sound like in any way I'm being sexist at all, but it was a chauvinistic society by today's standards. I don't say it was a better way of living, but I do believe that there's certain things which went on back then, or the way society acted back then. I think we can reflect on that, look at it, learn from it, and I do think that there are some traditions which should be upheld today, and one of them which I strongly believe in, if I can get opinionated for a moment, is that ladies who choose to be stay-at-home mums should not be criticised for their efforts. They're considered somewhat lazy or unambitious, and I think there's nothing more important than raising children and raising them correctly so that they don't become hoodies. Refer back to the news story. So anyway, I digress, I'm rambling again, but another important role of a lady was that of a diplomat, and we have an excerpt from here from Christine de Pizan's book called How the Good and Wise Princess, by princess she terms all noble ladies princesses, by the way, in the same way that all men are lords in a literary sense. So, how the good and wise princess will make every effort to restore peace between the prince and the barons if there is any discord. Goes on to say, if any neighbouring or foreign prince wishes for any reason to make war against her husband, or if her husband wishes to make war on someone else, the good lady will consider this thing carefully, bearing in mind the great evils and infinite cruelties, destruction, massacres, and detriment to the country that result from war. The outcome is often terrible. She will ponder long and hard whether she can do something, always preserving the honour of her husband, to prevent this war. In this cause she will wish to work and labour carefully, calling God to her aid, and by good counsel she will do whatever she can to find a way of peace. So to me that's a fairly important ideal for anyone to uphold, but it was especially thrust upon the ladies, and I guess the clergymen as well, to try and keep these warlike men in check, because they were very proud, they were very arrogant, and they were very warlike. They were bred for war from a very young age, so the ladies had to act as their soft side and temper that more or less, and move in and try and persuade them against these sort of courses. Another great example of lady acting as a diplomat is I can't remember the lady's name, you'll have to forgive me on this, but a letter was written to Sir John Hawkwood. Sir John Hawkwood, of course, rose from being a middle class man, rose through the ranks, became wealthy in warfare and battle, and went on to become one of the most famous and one of the most successful mercenary leaders in all of Christendom. Also known as Giovanni Acuto by the Italians, he was a condottieri captain. And he was urged by this lady from England. She wrote him a letter urging him to give up his terrible, unchivalric ways of a mercenary and to come back and do his duty as God has deemed it, as a knight of England, come back and serve his king. So, again, the lady was making an attempt, a diplomatic attempt at bringing him home. Possibly she had ulterior motives, who knows? Maybe she was a relative, or maybe she had a fondness for him. I can't say for certain, it escapes me. I can't even remember where I actually read that, so I will have to look it up for a future episode. But again, it shows the importance of, or the power of, the ladies in which they can address the men. A clever lady, also Catherine de Pizan, speaks on ladies. They need to be astute and clever. They need to be learned in arts of war, especially logistics, and in arming a man, understanding war. And she's been around, even as a young girl, a lady's been around men discussing war and such from a very young age, and so she should have a fairly good grasp upon it. And so she'll offer advice, generally quietly, and it's the duty of a lady to offer advice and to, I guess, for lack of a better term, I guess we'll say manipulate events. That's a really horrible word to use. I guess influence events. Yes, we'll be politically correct. That'll be a lovely change, won't it? To influence events without seeming that she's influencing them. Now, that sounds deceptive, I know, especially in our day and age, we might consider that a little underhanded, and I know there's some guys out there going, yeah, that sounds like a woman. But generally, a woman, she had to be able to do these things and appear clever, and her praises would be sung afterwards by those around her, therefore endearing her and making her more valuable as a lady to her father or to her husband or whomever she may serve. So that was something else which they had to do. Again, we're talking more along the lines of nobility. I do apologise, but most of my knowledge comes directly from that kind of thing. What I do know about the middle class ladies is that they had a lot more freedom in choice of marriage. We hear about it all the time that these young girls are married off at this ridiculously young age to men whom they've never even met before. Now, generally speaking, that was primarily the nobles that did that, and it was always political and economic, or politically and economically influenced as to why they did that. There's strong evidence which supports it that the ladies could actually have a lot, the middle class ladies had a lot more choice, a lot more freedom of choice. And one article which talks about that in particular is from History Today, the February 2008 issue, and there's an article called The Right to Say No in the Middle Ages. It's an article by Jeremy Goldberg, and he investigates to what extent women in medieval England could choose whether or not to marry. And there's three cases that he has in here, and it's really interesting stuff. He examines three stories of disputed marriages and discusses definitions of consent and how they impinged on a medieval woman's right to marry when and whom she chose. Medieval marriage was the canon law, or the codification of the church's teaching enforceable through the church courts, distinguished between words of present and future consent. So, I would like to marry you, or I will marry you when I finish my apprenticeship, and other such wordings constituted future consent. And it was considered a contract, a spoken contract, but they weren't considered binding unless the couple, as courting couples were wont to do, consummated the relationship. If it was consummated, pretty much it meant they were married. So words in the present tense, such as I take you to be my wife, or a lady saying to a gentleman, I plight you my troth, were immediately binding. So, and they didn't even have to consummate that. But the aforementioned ones, such as I'd like to marry you, and then, you know, they get it on, they bump ugly, so to speak, and it becomes a binding relationship. So a lady could actually choose to do that, and legally it would stick. There was nothing that her father or someone else who fancied her could do. There's also instances, the article goes on to say, how a man would come along and he would force a lady to consent to marriage, whether it was through physical threat or possibly extortion or blackmail or something like that, and he could force her to consent. But if she had already betrothed herself, even secretly, she could bring that up and legally could have a forced marriage dismissed, and it could never take place. So obviously, if a lady did that, if a man had perhaps if we imagine a father had organised a marriage and this lady who married for love raced out and betrothed herself to her lover, then you can imagine that even though it's legally binding, that father could be fairly grumpy about the whole situation, and he may take matters into his own hands in an underhanded way, or he could disown the daughter, different things like that. So they had a lot more right to choose in the middle classes. Of course, in nobility, as we've spoken before, young ladies, especially in the wealthier levels of society, especially the royal courts, ladies were somewhat considered to be an asset, and an asset which could be used for political and economic binding relationships between families, even between nations, and we see that in history over and over and over again. So the ladies' role in society, it was very dominant. And Indeed, men used to go to war over ladies. Ladies used to cause wars. Ladies generally, they didn't fight in wars very often. Now, ladies could never be a knight, and I know a lot of, I do a lot of school shows and such today and speak on that subject, and you always hear, that's sexist, that's so unfair, ladies should be able to be knights. Well, yes, in this day and age I do agree, but back then it was a different society, they did things differently, and ladies could not become knights. Ladies, however, could participate in war, especially a noble lady whose husband was off fighting somewhere else, if he was perhaps fighting in a campaign away from home and the home manor or castle or town was besieged, then the ladies quite often would take part in the defence of that. And you read various accounts of various ladies who do put on their late husband's armour if they've been widowed, and they may lead the troops. Obviously, the ladies are probably not as highly trained as the men, but in the same sense, the men would have been fairly loyal. Men that were associated with that lady, if they were part of a household and the lord had been killed, quite often these troops would stay on in the household, and quite often they would serve with as much loyalty. So you can imagine this lady's still fairly powerful. She commands the troops at home while the man is away and takes care of financial matters. You can imagine if you've been disrespectful to the lady, there's every chance that you're going to come across a whole lot of trouble when the lord returns, or if perhaps the lady's son finds out about it, it could get really messy. So ladies could actually influence events in their favour within the household in the military sense of the matter as well. So a lot of people, I might just quickly point out, a lot of people say, well, what about Joan of Arc? She got in armour and she fought in battles and so on and so forth. Well, yes, but she wasn't a knight. She was still just a lady. She was considered somewhat, I guess you could almost say, moral support. She was, and I don't mean to detract from her in any way, shape or form, but the reality of it is she didn't go out and she didn't fight in the same way that the men did. She was a token leader, and she claimed to speak with saints and with God himself, and that's where a lot of her power came from, was from that. And she was somewhat of a, I guess we'd say, celebrity and political tool, I guess, as well, you could argue. There's a lot of people who are a lot more knowledgeable on Joan of Arc than I am, so if there's something I've said which you disagree with, I urge you to get in contact with me or get onto the forums and discuss it a little more. What else do we have? Courtly love. We can talk a little bit about courtly love. Ladies held a lot of power, as I said, over men-at-arms. A lot of that stemmed from the art of courtly love. Now, the art of courtly love, I actually intend on doing a more researched piece on this, which I can speak about in more depth, I guess. But the art of courtly love was pretty much, ideally, it was meant to be an unrequited love, very romantic, as we would view it in this day and age, where men would go off and they do grand deeds, or they would do horrible things to themselves, or they would pretty much the lady would serve as a muse, pretty much as an inspiration to do chivalric deeds and do great and wonderful things. Now, a lady held great power over men within the system of courtly love. It's very complex. Fundamentally, it sounds really basic, but it actually is really complex. There's a lot of little nuances and a lot of little intricacies involved in the art of courtly love. And I actually, to date, I really don't have my head fully around it. I'm still studying it. I've heard a little bit about it, and I've read about it, and I've spoken about it. But it's still something which does elude me a little, I must admit that. But we might talk a little bit about the rules of love from the Book of Courtly Love by Andreas Capellanus. I think that one's from the 12th or the 13th century. I'm not too sure. Forgive me for not being entirely accurate with that. But anyway, we'll talk about some of the rules of courtly love. The first rule of courtly love is an interesting one. The state of marriage does not properly excuse anyone from loving. So that in itself speaks pretty much about political and economic marriages, doesn't it, when you think about it? It's saying that that just because you're married doesn't mean that you can't love someone. So, I mean, it's interesting to hear that, and it goes to prove that a lot of couples who got married really weren't in love with each other. But hey, how is that different to today? So we'll move on to the next rule. He who does not feel jealousy is not capable of loving. Well, that kind of makes sense too, really, even in our day and age. Saying if you're not jealous, then well, if you can't get jealous, then really you can't love someone. Another one is no one can love two people at the same time, and I think that rings true. You can't be in love with two people at once. They didn't believe you could back in the Middle Ages, and I firmly believe that you can't today. You can lust for two people at the same time, but not love, at least not true courtly love or true chivalric love. Rule number four is, it is well known that love is always either growing or declining. They believed it wasn't static, it was something that was either decreasing or it was increasing all the time. It never just plateaued, it never sat there. So what they would often do in order to ensure that it's increasing rather than declining, men would quite often go off and do crazy deeds at the request of their ladies, or not even at the request of their ladies, but they may say to a lady, I'm going to go off and I'm not going to return to you until I've faced 100 men in the lists or something like that in your honour. So that's something that they used to do a lot, and quite often they'd get killed from it. And they used to do it to win the favour or to show their lady that they loved them a lot. A lot of the time they might even not speak of whom they love, so it would be, as we mentioned, an unrequited love or an anonymous love, where he'd do it without even the lady would never ever know. He'd love her from a distance. So, which I guess in this day and age is almost considered fanaticism, which could borderline upon stalking. I suppose there's laws against courtly love in this day and age, mate. So, what else have we got? We'll skip to... here's one. Here's rule number six. A male does not fall in love until he has reached full manhood. Yes, go and tell some of those 12-year-old kids that, will you? Some of those hoodies. Bloody hoodies. Yes. So, rule number seven is an interesting one as well. A mourning period of 2 years for a deceased lover is required of the surviving partner. Rule number eight, no one should be prevented from loving except by reason of his own death. Let's skip across to some of the other ones. This is a good one. Rule number 23, a man tormented by the thought of love eats and sleeps very little. Come on, gents, you must remember that before you went, or when you first met your lady love. You could hardly eat and you could hardly sleep, and all you did was think of her. They had a rule for that. If you weren't doing that, then you weren't in love. Well, ideally speaking, of course. What else do we have? Everything a lover does ends in the thought of his beloved. Now, I'll quickly point out, when the word lover does not have the same meaning as it does in this day and age. It could have back then, but generally when we mention lover in this day and age in our society, it's sort of like, ooh, you know, we know exactly what it means. But back then, it just meant someone who you loved. It didn't actually mean that you've consummated or been intimate with the person. So that's the meaning of lover in the medieval context. So rule 25, a true lover considers nothing good but what he thinks will please his beloved. And we spoke about that or touched upon it from another angle in terms of great deeds of chivalry. The man would ride off and perform these crazy suicidal or crazy acts of chivalry. Another great example, or a great example, I don't think I've mentioned one, is the real Ulrich von Liechtenstein. We see it in the movie A Knight's Tale. He sits there and gets clobbered in the lists because his lady said, oh, all you do is is you're just trying to win. You can do that if you really loved me. You'd lose pretty much. And so he's gone, well, I'll show you. And that actually did the historic 13th century Ulrich von Liechtenstein actually did do that. But something else he did, he rode around and jousted pretty much in a lady's dress. Something was mentioned from his true love, and a challenge was issued, and to prove his love to her and to show that he loved her so much he would humiliate himself, he rode around Christendom dressed as the goddess Venus. So basically he was in drag and he went around jousting. Now the reasons he was in drag was because he did it to show his lady how much he loved her, that he'd risk his reputation and risk his image, his big macho image as a prize tournament jouster, to show how much he loved her. So some other rules of courtly love. Nothing forbids one woman being loved by two men or one man by two women. Now what that means is it doesn't mean what we may think it means in this modern day and age for you dirty-minded peasants out there. Okay, so get that thought out of your head. What it does mean is that one woman may be loved by two men. So that could mean there could be two men that are out there performing these great deeds. And a great example of that, if I can mention it, is from Geoffrey Chaucer's A Knight's Tale, where the two knights of the story both fall in love with the one lady. So it's nothing, the lady hasn't done anything wrong on her part. In fact, she doesn't even know these two men are in love with her. And these two men find out that they both love the same lady. So to decide who is going to love this lady from a distance, because neither of them actually believed that they would actually meet the lady or actually speak to her. It was going to be a love from afar, but they decided to decide who was going to rightly love her in the courtly style. They found a field and they went out and they pretty much beat the snot out of each other until the lady's father, the Lord, he's turned up, and the lady was there as well. And they're, you know, what are you blokes doing out here fighting? This is the Australian abridged version of it. You know, why are you blokes beating the bejesus out of each other? What's going on here? And you know, you're forbidden to fight, and one of you shouldn't even be here because you were banished years ago. And basically, what's happened is these two men have gone, oh, we're fighting because we love your daughter. And to which the daughter was, she thought that was wonderful, that these two men were beating the hell out of each other over her. And that was, again, they were willing to, these two men, from memory, they were friends or they were brothers, it was something like that, but they were a fairly close relationship, but they were willing to beat the snot out of each other and possibly kill one another to be able to declare their love secretly to the lady. So, and the same goes for one man by two women. Of course, that doesn't mean any fighting between the ladies. That's most unladylike in the Middle Ages, physical fighting. But what that could mean is that that two ladies could be enamored of one man, and quite often courtly love often involved secret messages, things like that, like mystery lovers. Like you imagine you get the Valentine's card from a secret paramour who loves you from afar and you never get to find out who that is. That was very popular in the Middle Ages. Another couple of rules, we'll just talk about it very quickly, is a good character alone makes someone worthy of love. So that means if you're a good person, you're worthy to be loved. If you're a bad person, then really to love that person is it's a loss of honour on your part, pretty much. Another rule is no one can love unless they are compelled by the eloquence of love. So that means you don't do it just because it's fashionable. It's like, who are you going to love this summer, Sir Rodney? You know, it was nothing like that. It wasn't a status symbol. It wasn't a prestigious thing. It was done because it was, you were compelled by the eloquence of it, more or less. One last one, we'll find this one: a man in love is always fearful. So that's fairly self-explanatory, really. Well, actually, maybe he's fearful his wife is going to find out he's in love with someone. So maybe that's the fear of it. But generally, he's fearful for his love, pretty much. So, and another one was, if a love becomes public... I can't even remember where that one's written, but it's something along the lines, if a love becomes public, here it is, love that is made public rarely lasts. That's another interesting one as well, I think. That's about it for my skewed outlook on courtly love. I hope I haven't butchered it too much. As I said, it's still something which eludes me a little. Maybe I'm not too sure why. Possibly I should read more on it, finish reading Christine De Pizan's works. The book which I was reading those rules out of, by the way, it's actually a it's from the Code of Love by Andreas Capellanus, but the book I'm reading from is The Book of Courtly Love by Andrea Hopkins. It's a great little book. Check it out. It's got some great manuscript images in it, and it's got the rules of courtly love and the culture of it and a whole bunch of other things like that. It's really cool. Something else I wanted to briefly read before we move on is one of the short tales from the Chronicles of Froissart. The reason I bring this tale up is because, interestingly enough, it centres upon a siege, a gallant knight, and a lady who was actually in charge of the town and in charge of defences and things such as that. It's in regards, the year is 1342, and it's the siege of Hennebont, and it shows a knight who is aspiring to not so much, well, possibly impress the lady, but also do his duty. And basically what happens is the knight known as Sir Walter de Manny has arrived from England to help the Countess of Montfort, and finds the besieged town much troubled by a siege machine, which is bombarding the town incessantly with large stones. And after the entertainment, Sir Walter Manny, who was captain of the English, inquired of the Countess the state of the town and of the enemy's army. Now, obviously, he would not have inquired of this to her if he didn't think that she knew. So, obviously, this lady has a very educated and astute view upon the state of the town, its condition, and that of the enemy's army as well. So, obviously, she's probably not doing all of the work herself. She's going to delegate, but basically, she's the manager of this town, more or less. And upon looking out of the window, Sir Walter de Manny said he had a great inclination to destroy a large machine which was placed so near to the town, and much annoyed the lady. And if any man would second him, he'd ride out and perform such a deed just to please the lady. Well, basically, the men, they rode out, they destroyed the machine, and they started riding back. By this point in time, some French cavalry had gathered and started riding towards them. Sir Walter Manny, seeing this, exclaimed, "May I never be embraced by my mistress and dear friend if I enter the castle or fortress before I have unhorsed one of these gallopers." So that's interesting as well to note that. Basically, they turned around, they fought the men. There was a great conflict. I won't go into too much detail. As interesting as it is, I'd like to keep this centred more on the ladies than on the blokes. But basically, there were many brilliant actions, captures and rescues were seen, and those of the town who'd not been of the party to destroy the large machine now issued forth, and ranging themselves upon the banks of the ditch, made such good use of their bows, they forced the enemy to withdraw. So, Sir Walter de Manny rides back and sees the Countess of Montfort, and she comes down from the castle to meet them, and with a most cheerful countenance kiss Sir Walter Manny and all of his companions one after the other, like a noble and valiant dame. So that's coming from one of the most, the most well-known chroniclers of the Hundred Years' War. A lot of people dismiss his stuff as being, a little proper, like it's propaganda, and pro-English, or pro-Edward III, or even pro-Queen Philippa, because he did come over with her court. That's Jean Froissart, the man who wrote them. But, it goes on to show the importance of ladies and how they did revere them in medieval society. So now if I can address ladies and reenactment, I'd like to talk about that a little bit. I may offend some of the ladies, so that may urge them to listen to the following piece. It's not a cheap plug. I'm not trying to keep listeners interested, and I'm not trying to cause any sort of controversy which may cause people to fly onto the forums and give Sir Justin a piece of their mind in regards to this. I would like to hear constructive debate. These are, after all, my own opinions. And with all this build-up and hype, I hope you're not too disappointed about what I'm about to say. I hope it lives up to it. But basically, there's two... Pretty much, when I joined a reenactment group, All the guys, they're all doing their fighting, they're doing their things. Their role is very, very clear, very understandable, or at least it was for me. And I remember I said to one of the ladies, because I was hoping to get my wife interested in joining the group as well, and I said to one of the ladies, "So what do the ladies do?" And the lady said, "We just sit there and look pretty." I thought, wow, I guess it helps if you are pretty. I'm not too sure what the ugly ladies were doing, but I suppose they were attempting to sit there and look pretty. But I thought, well, surely they did more than that in the Middle Ages. At that point in time, I was not very well educated on the Middle Ages at all. And to me, it was a bit of a disappointment. I felt, well, there is going to be more than that involved in that of a lady's role. Basically, I just wasn't happy with that answer. So, the next side of things, so that's option A for ladies in reenactment, well, as far as I was educated, is to sit there and look pretty. We make the men look good. Oh, okay, wow. So, the next option for a lady in reenactment was to become a combatant. Now, to me, that served two purposes. First of all, it wasn't very historically accurate. To see a lady take to the field in tournament or in warfare, really, it was an exception to the rule. To portray that in modern reenactment gives the public the wrong idea. Not only that, but now it's just, again, it's just my personal opinion, but to me, most ladies do not make, theatrically speaking, they don't make great combatants, okay? This sounds really, really chauvinistic, I understand, but I don't believe that most ladies, some ladies can, some ladies that I've come across are downright scary, but generally a lady cannot go out onto the field and portray the role of a man-at-arms convincingly. Not that I've ever seen done, okay? I have seen ladies out there in combat. I've seen them act as men-at-arms, act as knights or what have you, and they just look like ladies dressed in armour. It doesn't look convincing in my eyes, and so I'm pretty much against that. It's and don't get me wrong, I'm not being sexist. It's the same as can we imagine the movie Troy for a moment and casting a lady in the role of Achilles. She's going to look like a lady, okay? And besides which, Achilles was a guy. So unless it's some sort of alternate take on history, then it should be kept the way that it was kept. So the ladies, they see themselves, and a lot of the ladies that take up combat, and you can't blame them, they take up combat because they say, oh, well, it's boring just doing the lady stuff. So, and I can understand that based on the first point that I made, the first thing that was said to me, ladies just sit there and look pretty. So in reenactment circles, at least here in Brisbane, the ones that I'm familiar with, they say that a lady can either just sit there and look pretty, or she has to become a combatant. Now, to me, I find that insulting. I find that insulting to ladies in general. I found that insulting to come back to my wife and say, well, the only options you've got is to either go out and fight or to just sit there and look pretty and do nothing. And that just didn't ring true for me. So I feel there's a whole lot more that the ladies can do. And as a result, my knowledge reflects this very thing which I'm speaking of, where the ladies are pigeonholed into two categories and not given a lot of encouragement to do anything other than that. So that's just from my experience, of course, and And, well, I make it no secret that I'm not terribly impressed by ladies in combat roles. And actually, Gwen from Historic Enterprises said it very nicely once upon a time in the Fire Striker Living History forums or medieval forums, where she said that she felt that a lady who took up combat because she felt that ladies didn't do anything important, she felt insulted by that, to say that, well, you're basically saying that ladies in the Middle Ages were insignificant and boring. And I feel the same way. I really do. I don't think the ladies should... If you're going to be out there doing combat, you've got to look like a man, you've got to act like a man, and you've got to, you know, to pull it off convincingly. If you're doing it privately, say with the SCA or something like that, that's the Society of Creative Anachronism, if you're doing it at a private event, then fine, do it for competitive or for, you know, for whatever reasons you feel, you know, if you're getting something out of it, I think that's great, and I don't think ladies should be excluded from martial activities. But when it comes to public performance, portraying the role, I think that it's, you can imagine for one moment that a man who goes, oh, I'm not really fond of doing the fighting, I find the lady's role much more interesting, I'm going to dress up as a lady and I'm going to portray a lady. So don't feel for a moment I'm being sexist. That doesn't work either way, okay? Also, I've been on the field before where there has been a lady on the opposing force, and I've had someone, well, I've been part of a team where we've been addressed, now there's a lady on the other side of amongst our opponents, if any of you blokes come across said lady, take it easy. I'm like, I'm thinking to, well, I've actually said it out loud, pig's bum, I'm going to treat her the same as I'll treat any other combatant. If you're out there to play the game, then you play the game by its rules, and don't expect anyone to pull punches. And I'm certain that the lady did not want anyone to pull punches for one moment, but she is only a small lady, and I feel one stout blow from any combatant would have crumpled her into a small heap, much akin to a wrecked car, pretty much. So, and that's nothing against her, that's just something which, well, the laws of physics really dictate that, don't they? And as I say, ladies out on the field, they do look like ladies. They generally don't look like men, and that's just the way we're made. Sorry. So that's about my take on ladies in reenactment today. I do think that there's a whole worthwhile, and I mean the little bit of knowledge which I have garnered, it says to me that the ladies were so much more than what we think that they are or think that they were in the Middle Ages. So let's do them some justice. Let's do the ladies of the Middle Ages, not middle-aged ladies. Well, I guess we can do them justice as well. But let's do these ladies some justice. Get up off our bums, especially the guys who are reenacting, and find out a little bit more about ladies in the Middle Ages. Let's stop just taking a lot of these things for granted, or, you know, oh, the ladies just sat around and acted pretty. No, they did so much more. So let's go out and find out what that is. And hopefully once I'm finished doing that, I'll be able to report on ladies a lot more accurately. I would really like to get Gwen onto the show. She is a endless supply of knowledge about ladies in the Middle Ages, and I'm sure she can do it far more justice than I can. So, as I said, I'm not going to promise what episode I'll be able to get people on, but I will be aiming to get some people on, some well-learned authorities about ladies in the Middle Ages, and talk about it a little bit more. Now, this feature has been rather strongly opinionated. It probably has been a little inaccurate in places, I have no doubts. There's a lot of things which I've probably forgotten to mention because I'm not using a script, but I do hope it has been enjoyable to some extent. I hope you've learned something. I hope your mind has been provoked. And if you have any opinions, jump over onto the forums and voice them, okay? Let's not be rude about it. I'm probably being a little bit cheeky in presenting some of these views and opinions. But, well, that's just the Australian nature, really. So head on over to the forums. Make your voice be heard about medieval ladies and what you think about this particular segment and what you think about my opinions. And if you'd like to rebuke them in any way or support them in any way, I'd love to hear about it.
Let us venture forth, lords and ladies, into the busy marketplace. Wares of all kinds you will find here. Stick close, and I'll keep the cut purses and charlatans off your backs. I know of a merchant house just over here, where we can relax and take our time considering today's goods and services. Ah, here we are now. Let's go inside and lose this crowd, shall we?
Here we are. Come on in. Take a seat. Did you see that group of ladies there in the marketplace that were staring at me? Most malevolently, I would say. Odd. That's very odd indeed. Anyway, here we are. We've travelled down through the quaint little town away from the keep into the busy marketplace. Here we are at our favourite merchant's shop again. And this episode, we're going to talk about the Pavilion Book. Well, among other things, but first of all, we'll talk about the Pavilion Book. This is a book which is a guide to buying, maintaining, and living in a medieval-style tent by John Latour of the Dragonwing Tents website. He's actually he's quite a knowledgeable source on tents. He's been doing this for a very long time. He's very well known in the SCA, or the Society of Creative Anachronism, and he's just produced a book. It's been out for a little bit now, but this book is pretty much it's the one-stop resource for our buying, maintaining, and living in a medieval tent. John himself is a professional tent maker and long-time reenactment enthusiast. And in the book, he talks about choosing the best tent for your budget and needs, how to make your tent last longer and perform better, and what you need to know about it, cleaning and repairing it, laying out your campsite, furnishing and painting your tent. And it also has a section for tent makers or budding tent makers, and gives information on designing the ideal tent, including its design, choosing fabric and the right sort of tools, and how to sew the seams and hems and such, choosing the right timber for tent poles. It even has stuff about decorating tent poles and things like that. It's a really great book. It's very straightforward. There's no mucking about. It's really easy to read, and it's full of really good advice and great information which you might not know about otherwise. Even myself, who's been doing this for quite a long time, there's a lot of things in there which I never even would have thought of, and it's a great little resource. Really inexpensive too, so it's a very well bound book, and it's a soft cover, and I'd recommend it to anyone who's interested in medieval tents in reenactment, or even just camping in a medieval style tent for private or public use. It's a great book. You can get it from or if you just go to the website, it's midtown.net/dragonwing. Have a look there. I'm pretty sure he's got a list of suppliers there. You can buy it directly from the website as well. Or if you're in Australia, you can buy it from my own little shop called the Medieval Emporium. So I haven't got it up on the website there, and at the moment I actually don't have any copies in stock. I've actually only just received the book, and I've had a look at it, and it's well worth me stocking, I think. And so I'll have some copies in stock hopefully very shortly. But just contact me if you're in Australia and you're after a copy of that, or nearby Australia. Otherwise, I would urge you to visit the website and buy it from him direct. And while we're on the subject of books, I received my copy of Nick Millier's The Goff Map, which I spoke about in, I think it may have been the last podcast, or the podcast before that at the very latest. I thought I'd give a quick review of the book. It's actually very well, it's a hardcover book, and it's of sturdy construction. I believe it's stitched bindings. But rather than just carry on about that kind of thing, I'd rather talk about its content, because to me, I mean, a book that's in great condition physically, it's a bonus. It's really the content which I'm mostly interested in, and for all I care, if it's got great content on pictures, remember it's got to have good pictures, then I really couldn't care less about the bindings. Admittedly, it's a very annoying when you pay good cash for a book where the pages fall out, but if it's the only book which addresses a subject that you're really keen on learning about, then, well, you just have to put up with it, really, don't you? So, I actually haven't read it from cover to cover as yet, and as I stated earlier in the podcast, there's a good chance I won't at first. I'm going to try to, though. It looks really interesting. First of all, it goes into talking about the map. First and foremost, I'm pretty sure I mentioned that in the news report that it was from the reign of Edward III. Now, that was from the source. That wasn't a mistake on my own part. It was a mistake from the source which I found the news story on. I actually can't remember what that was at the moment. But it's claimed that it was very probably from the early 14th century during the reign of Edward I. Now, it goes into some detail about that. Then it talks about map making in the Middle Ages, and then it goes on to it talks about the map's audience as well, who it may have been designed for and who may have viewed it and things such as that. Then it goes into some details about the map itself and what the different symbols and the red lines and things like that, what it actually means and what they actually represent. The most interesting part of the book which I've come across, or one of the most interesting parts, just from flicking through it, is it's got a section about rivers, routes, regional features, settlements. It talks about forests. Hadrian's Wall gets a mention. Animals which appear on the map, and hills and mountains, lakes, different things like that. And also it mentions roads a little bit as well. And it's really interesting to read like different things about the forests and the mountains and things like that as well. So it's actually got some copies of some other maps from later periods, pretty much. And they're comparing the Gough map to later period maps, showing how accurate it actually is. And it is pretty amazing to see how accurate they actually did get it for the period in which it was made. Another little section, it talks about the contents of the map in terms of the shires, or the, I'm pretty sure that's what you call them over there in the UK, you call them shires. So we're talking, and it covers everything from Scotland, England, and I'm pretty sure I haven't had a good look at it yet. It doesn't cover Ireland, but it does cover some of the islands, such as the Orkney Islands and the Western Isles. So it has a whole lot about Scotland in there as well. It talks a bit about the different shires marked on the map. Scotland itself is not as well documented as England is, on this map, that is. I don't mean to say the documentation in the book, but the map itself doesn't have a lot of features of Scotland, and they believe this is because during that period of time, Scotland, to the English, was still mostly unexplored. So they only put on the key locations of things which they absolutely knew existed, and tried to be as accurate as they could. It's got a big listing in the back of all of the towns, villages, or settlements rather, I guess we could collectively call them. It's got a big listing of them by shire. So you've got, not even by shire, but by region. So you've got Durham, Lincolnshire, Northumberland, Yorkshire, Nottinghamshire, Staffordshire, Westmoreland, the Isle of Man, a big listing of all the different settlements and notable features. So it really is a pretty cool book. The map in the back, I should have had a look at the blurb a little bit closer, but the map in the back is actually much smaller than I envisioned it. It's actually I'm not sure, technically speaking, what you'd call the size of the paper, but it's the size of 3A4 sheets of paper. But even still, it's a great little map. I do wish it had been a little bit bigger, and perhaps if I had read a little more closely and taken the measurements into consideration, because they do have them printed on their review and website, but it just didn't sink in with me. Also, it has a listing of all the rivers on the map, and it shows it's got different roads as well. Roads, here we are. It's got the roads as well. So, and it covers rivers from one coast to the other in all directions, and then it shows, or it mentions roads and the towns that it passes through. So it mentions main roads, secondary roads, and local roads, and their different branches as well. So it's a really interesting book. I'm really looking forward to getting into a little bit more, and I would recommend that book to anyone interested in medieval England. That's about all for the Marketplace this month. We're starting to head over an hour in length of the podcast, so I'll just leave it at those two things. Hopefully have a bigger medieval marketplace for the next episode, and we'll move on to the closing part of the show. Thank you. And here we are at the end of another episode of the All Things Medieval podcast. Haven't got any listener feedback this month, which I'm going to assume no news is good news. So I'll keep up the good work and give myself a pat on the back. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, as controversial as some of it has been. I'm sure some of you have already picked up. I can be fairly strongly opinionated on certain topics. I invite feedback. I invite some conversation and some debate on the matter. You know, I'm really up for that kind of thing. I find it stimulating and interesting, and I'd love to hear other people's viewpoints on it as well. Do you agree with me? Do you disagree with me? And that can be anything on the podcast. Doesn't have to be the controversial subject of what we spoke about in the main feature, but anything that you like. If there's something you disagree with, or something that you feel that I haven't clarified enough on, or something you think is good or bad or whatever, get in contact with me. Okay, you can get in contact with me at Sir Justin on the Sir Justin website. So that's sirjustin.com. The forums are sirjustin/index.php, and then we've got the All Things Medieval Podcast .blogspot.com, so you can access the show notes there. I actually haven't linked that one up with the rest of the websites, and when I get some time and I guess another dummy's guide book, then I'll get into that and I'll start sorting that out. Other than that, thanks for tuning in and listening again. Hopefully you'll hear from me again sooner rather than later. And until then, go and find something medieval to do. Salut! Don't you see how love has wounded me, flinging his arrow so that my whole heart is set ablaze? The arrow was poisoned, and I have been wounded in two places because I received the blow that causes me such anguish, both through the ear and the eye. There never was such a skilled archer as love, who strikes so surely.